yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host. June 26th, 2013, this is Alternative Visions, where we talk about solutions to the problems, not just the crises. Okay, today we have an interesting guest, most interesting guest. My guest is Ben Manske. And Ben and I are going to discuss the topic of which way the progressive left in the U.S., where do we go from here, given the juncture that this country seems to be at economically and politically. Just by way of a little intro to my guest here, Ben is the chief of staff to the president in the Green Shadow Cabinet. As you know, I'm in part of the Green Shadow Cabinet, the Shadow Federal Reserve Chair, and my colleague here, Ben Manske, is in the catbird seat here, chief of staff to the president. Anyway, Ben has a long history here in democratic movements, labor movement, community action movements, and so on and so forth. If you want to see his full bio, you just go to the posting here of the show on the website, and you'll get a good idea of Ben's admirable background. Ben, you there?
I am, Jack.
Glad oh, very good. Okay, you. Ben, let's start. We got a real big question here, a real big topic, but I thought we would step back and look at the broader picture. I can't think of anyone better to discuss this with, because I'm sure you're wrestling with this question every day yourself. Last week we had a show called Magic Bullet Politics. My guest and I critiqued, we're discussing the bane of the progressive left in the U.S., which is single issues. Everyone chasing their own single issue, everyone fragmented, isolated. Protests, demonstrations of a couple hundred people here, there, everywhere, and nothing really unified that brings together people under one big umbrella to have more effectiveness. And as I and my guest last week discussed, we need to get beyond that. I think the progressives and left are moving in that direction. But how do we move faster? How do we move further? Where do we move to? Who do we move with? All these key questions here of the left in the future. A lot of cynicism and disenchantment. People put a lot of hope into Barack Obama in 2008, totally misread the fellow and where he was coming from and his background and his politics. Of course, he played that very well. In my book, by the way, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, the first chapter, really looks at Obama, the candidate, in 2008 and his positions and so forth. And clearly, the message in that first chapter is Obama was the most conservative of the three candidates at the time, more conservative than Hillary Clinton, believe it or not, in his positions at least, and Edwards as well. So there was no real surprise to me when it turned out where he was really coming from, but lots of folks got misled in there. Wishful thinking, and understandably, people wanted to change so badly from George Bush. And then, of course, in 2012, everyone has been saying, or were saying last year, well, now if he gets elected a second time, he won't have to worry about elections and things will really change. Well, things are beginning to look even more conservative with civil liberties and surveillance and the economy and so forth than in his first term. Anyway, that's the context of where we are today. Disenchantment with the official choices and a kind of re-estimating where we are, where we're going, where we should go, and so forth. And the stakes are getting bigger and bigger and more important as time goes on. I'm sure you agree. Let's start with the Green Shadow Cabinet. I don't want to talk We've had other guests, Jill Stein and others, about the Green Shadow Cab. I don't want to talk specifically and only about that, but that's a good jump-off point. Tell us a little bit, to begin with, what the Green Shadow Cabinet is, and particularly some of its policies and where it sees itself going over the next 12 to 24 months politically. And we can then leap off from there and talk about not just the Green Shadow Cabinet and where it's going, but use that as a segue to discuss where the progressive left might or should or could be growing and how it would do so over the next couple of years. Fair enough?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, jump right in it and tell us about the GSC, and we'll just abbreviate it, and where it is now, where it sees itself going, and where it sees the U.S. Political environment going over the next 12 months.
Yeah, to understand where something's going, it's oftentimes helpful to look back at where it's coming from, and the reality is the Green Shadow Cabinet is an outgrowth, a project that is inspired by the Jill Stein for President campaign of 2012. It is a independent, nonpartisan effort, but the reason why it came together is that Dr. Jill Stein and Sherry Honkala, her running mate, were able to pull together that kind of an umbrella coalition in their campaign that many people believed, and I think increasingly more people believe, is necessary in the coming years. There was a very diverse cross-section of people in the labor movement, people who were in the student movement, farmers, people in indigenous communities, folks who are working to make the issue of poverty front and center in America today, basically all the people who make up the progressive movement who came together to support Dr. Stein and Sherry Honkala in their campaign last year. And people said, we need to continue this opposition voice, even if it's not an electoral voice at the national level. You know, there's certainly other ways to carry on the electoral campaign through the Green Party, through other independent parties. We need to have a way to bring together this coalition on an ongoing basis, and that's what the Green Shadow Cabinet is. It's nearly 100 prominent community activists, labor leaders, people who have been at the work of social change for many years, but also who, frankly, could do a better job of governing this country than the current administration in Washington, D.C. That's the job of the Green Shadow Cabinet. That's its function, is to show that another government is possible. And when you show that another government is possible by putting out on a daily basis statements of policies that contrast strongly with what the Obama White House and what the Republicans in Congress are doing together, you provide space for the movement to grow, to actually speak in its own voice as opposed to just protecting those in power. We can actually say what we want, what we're fighting for, and you provide inspiration for people to act. So the Green Shadow Cabinet is certainly not the entire movement. It doesn't aspire to be the entire movement. It's playing a role of bringing together a very diverse cross-section of America on an ongoing basis to show that another government is possible. And when people see that something is possible, then they try to make it probable if it's a good thing. And I think that the policies that listeners can see right now, if you go to greenshadowcabinet.us, are excellent policies that actually reflect the majority of Americans on most issues in terms of their views, and certainly the agenda of the progressive movement.
Okay, sounds like very needed work in the area of developing programs, proposals, policies, ideas, and so forth. I absolutely agree with you. Running around with slogans or abstract recommendations really don't get you very far, because real folks want to see real answers, real solutions, and they're going to be just justifiably skeptical until it looks realistic, pragmatic, and possible. So I absolutely agree. It's really important to have a very clear program in detail. Position papers, white papers, whatever you want to talk about, messages that can be distributed to in different form to all kinds of different folks without standing for something. What is it you stand for? No one's going to follow you. You know,
right.
They're not going to follow you with slogans. They're not going to follow you with homilies and generalities and so forth. You're just going to talk to yourself. So I really applaud that, and that's you know, one of the reasons I agreed to join the GSC, because it looked like that very much needed work was going to be undertaken. But beyond that, what's the next step for the GSC?
Yeah, well, the response has been tremendous, and I think the next step is to not only grow the community of people who look to the Green Shadow Cabinet as being a effort that speaks for them, that helps to raise up all of our voices together, but also for the Green Shadow Cabinet to begin to bring that broad coordination of all these different networks and types of people to bear on the pivotal issues of the day, because as we know, there are particular issues that come to a conflict point at different points in time. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin, and we were that conflict point for some time. I think we still wish we were, because we continue the struggle, but everybody around the country has their own problems to deal with now. But the reality is that in a situation like the Wisconsin uprising, or in a situation like the Chicago teacher strike this past year, there is a need for the entire movement, for people who are working in different areas and maybe have different immediate concerns in our lives, to come together and to bring our resources and our voices to bear to support that particular struggle. The Green Shadow Cabinet is about to do that for the first time next week. We will be launching a campaign against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a new trade regime being pushed by multinational corporations modeled after NAFTA and the WTO. It's yet another attempt by global capital to structure the global economy to profit them, to profit the very few, and to steal from the rest of us, and to make democracy impossible, not only in the United States, but in all the signatory countries to this Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. So the Green Shadow Cabinet is getting behind this fight against the TPP, because it is going to be one of the critical struggles of the next several months. And by bringing all the different sectors that are represented within the Green Shadow Cabinet, the people who are working on education issues, the people who are family farm activists, the anti-poverty campaigners, the labor movement people, the folks who are working on women's rights issues, and on, together on this, we can actually have a very significant impact. So what that's going to mean is not only putting out statements, although we'll be doing that for educational purposes, and also, again, to draw the line clearly between the government that is possible and the government that is in Washington, D.C., but also our cabinet members will be engaged in organizing protests. They will be involved in leveraging and bringing together the networks that they have credibility with across the country into this movement. And I think we'll be able to make a significant contribution.
Well, good topic, good choice. Broad campaign against the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, code word for free trade on steroids, dwarfs the NAFTA free trade agreement, North American free trade agreement, and it's two thoughts immediately come to mind. You know, I have interviewed Art Stamoulis, who is one of the leaders in that group. We had a great show for those interested. Just look back in the archives, I think back to January, when this thing was just beginning to emerge. It's pretty clear that this is a primary, the TPP, a priority for President Obama. Just as NAFTA was for Bill Clinton here. But this is 10 times worse, potentially, than even NAFTA in terms of job losses and impact on the U.S., negative impact on the U.S. economy. Great for U.S. multinational corporations, of course, but terrible for the rest of us, TPP. I would mention also that coming behind it is the TAP, Transatlantic
right.
Partnership. That's going to have a little bit more difficulty because the Europeans have some real issues on agriculture and so forth. And I just read that the U.S. Forewarned the Europeans that the protections for the French film industry were just unacceptable. So that's you know something coming behind us, driven by the U.S. The capitalists worldwide are pushing free trade everywhere, which is another name for a race to the bottom for the rest of the working classes. Now you said putting out position papers and so forth. It's good. You got to explain what your position is and how you don't need it, and what else should be the alternative. But you intimated, and would you explain a little bit more, what other actions are being considered? You mentioned this very important role of the GSE of bringing broad coordination, bringing to bear people coming together and so forth around pivotal issues like TPP. How do you propose to do that? How does the GSE anticipate playing a role in trying to bring people together in this fight against TPP? It's a shame we don't hear more about the organized labor movement. I remember in the 90s where the unions fought like hell against NAFTA and were organizing out in the street, but I don't see the FLCIO doing much of anything this time around. It looks like they already threw in the towel. So how do you see the GSE playing that role?
Well, there are, as you know, some international unions that are critically involved in the fight against the TPP, and certainly there need to be more. But I think that the unique contribution of the Green Shadow Cabinet, of this cabinet, is that it is politically independent. And you referenced the Obama administration's commitment to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to the TPP, and you referenced Bill Clinton's success in getting a Democratic Congress to go along with NAFTA. And I think what was different about the NAFTA fight from where we stand today is that in the early 1990s, there was no national independent political voice that was strong enough to provide an alternative to the Clinton administration. So there were Democrats in Congress who were gnashing their teeth. There were some Democrats, people who are still members of the Progressive Caucus today, who fought him. But overall, they were a small minority within their party, and you ended up with the Democratic Party essentially accomplishing for multinational corporations what the Republican Party had been unable to accomplish when George Bush, the senior, was in the White House. So that was then, this is now. Now we have a formation in the Green Shadow Cabinet that has the ability to reach millions of people around the country, that has recognizable figures involved in it, and which is politically independent of the Democrats and the Republicans, and quite willing to go after members of Congress regardless of party. And I think that that is a critical role. I found it in my own experience. I ran for state assembly here in Wisconsin several years back in 2010 as a Green Party candidate in a four-way race. There were four candidates of four political parties on the ballot. And I was able to do well enough that three labor unions, the teachers, the teaching assistants, and the firefighters, broke with the Democratic Party and endorsed me and backed me strongly in that race. And a number of prominent Democrats broke with their own party and backed me against their own nominee. And the impact of that election, in which I did very well, I got a third of the vote in this election, was that those same unions had essentially declared their independence from the political establishment. They weren't saying, we're Greens forever, we're allied to the Green Party. They were saying, we will choose the candidate who speaks for us and who we trust in, and we will not protect a candidate simply because they are a member of the Democratic Party. And guess which three unions were the first to go into the state capitol when the uprising began? It was the teaching assistants, the firefighters, and the teachers. So I think that there was a role there, and we were actually able to build a coalition in that election and then in the months following that led to the Wisconsin uprising. In fact, that coalition is still going strong in Wisconsin today. It's called the Wisconsin Wave, and listeners can check out what it's doing at wisconsinwave.org. So I use that as an example to say this is the kind of thing that you can do when you exercise independent political muscle. We have to have political independence, not just at the ballot box, but also in our work in general, if we are to be able to articulate our demands clearly, to be able to bring pressure to bear on those who are making the decisions. In this case, it's going to be members of Congress. And so the Green Shadow Cabinet, in this case, is very well positioned to bring that pressure to bear, to shame those people who are in leadership of different unions and community organizations that really have an obligation on behalf of their memberships to get engaged in this struggle, to bring them in, to create space for those who would wish to join the struggle but feel that they don't have the political space in which to do it. I think that's the critical role the Green Shadow Cabinet can play in the coming months. So what will the tactics be? I think it will vary from place to place. There'll probably be traditional tactics, rallies and demonstrations, maybe civil disobedience. You know, the nature of these things is that you go step by step and you have an idea of where you need to go. But the Green Shadow Cabinet's role in this process will be to bring the pressure to bear in the way that the organizations that are tied to the Democratic Party simply will not.
Well, I fundamentally agree with you. The key is independent political activity. For far too long, you know, labor itself has been too concerned at the very top end, of course, not embarrassing Democrats, which has hobbled it. And, you know, they expect something in return for their support, but they are getting less and less every year. Yeah, when I said criticized labor, I meant, you know, those at the very, very high level in Washington, D.C., what you described in Wisconsin and in Chicago with the teachers is absolutely the key. It will be the people who are on the front lines getting hammered who are those who will say, well, let's look for something else that works because subordinating ourselves to the Democratic Party certainly isn't getting us anywhere. In fact, it's part of the problem. And if you don't believe me, ask the Chicago teachers what they think of Democrat Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
They're no fan of his.
Yeah, and of course in Wisconsin, I wasn't there, wasn't an expert on that, but it seemed to me that the Democrats outmaneuvered the grassroots protest there by pushing one of their candidates and pushing everything into a recall election for a candidate who had already lost, who wouldn't even support the protesters in Wisconsin. So, of course, the recall was doomed. Recall, that is, of the governor, Republican governor, Scott Walker. That's a good example, I think, of how subordinating yourself to the Democratic Party and to electoral-only politics will get you a defeat. So I applaud the GSC's focus on independent politics. That's the way it's got to go. And independent politics can take many forms. It doesn't have to be a political party or anything, of course. But we really should be targeting, and I suspect you will be, those people in elected positions who don't take the right position on the TPP and should try to dump them. Of course, electoral activity is a justifiable strategy sometimes. And the problem is when it becomes the only strategy, then, you know, you can end up in a defeat. Anyway, but okay, so the Green Shadow Cabinet here, you know, you got 100 plus people, very sharp, experienced people, good thinkers, good actors, you know, and individually, you know, they've all of them have paid their dues, you know, and but how do you get folks in a local struggle, let's say in the case of the TPP? How are you going to get unions and others together? How would the GSC play a role in bringing them together in a particular kind of action? Let's say a mass protest or something on the docks and on the West Coast or something like that.
Well, I think it is important to recognize what I said earlier, which is that the Green Shadow Cabinet is not the movement, doesn't intend to be. We don't expect to be in the future the umbrella under which all activity takes place. Much short of that, we have a particular role to play However, in the short term, I think there are some things that we can do, even recognizing that this, the Green Shadow Cabinet has only been around for a month and a half. It was founded on Earth Day of this year. So we are in our early days, and we will see from the collective experience of the people involved and from the hundreds of people who have emailed us with ideas and suggestions in the last couple of weeks where this goes. But some things are clear already. There are many of us within the cabinet who are members of unions. There are some of us who are in leadership of various locals and also regional formations within the labor movement. There are many of us within the cabinet who are leaders of community organizations and student organizations and family farm organizations, people who are in critical roles to be able to impact what happens around the country, both within our own communities but also elsewhere. So I think that what we will be doing is we'll be providing that activating role for many people who have not been invited into this struggle yet. And we will be urging the people that we work with, and we will be doing this collectively, to engage in the struggle. So, you know, certainly I'm in no position in Madison, Wisconsin, to move labor councils in California or family farm activists or ranchers in Montana. But there are people in the cabinet who are, and vice versa. They may not be in a position to move the struggle forward here in Wisconsin or in the upper Midwest, but I'm in a position to do that. So I think that's what you'll see. You know, it sort of seems like we may be moving to a larger conversation, though, about what the larger movement needs to be doing in the coming years, and I'm happy to have that. I mean, for myself, I very much share your perspective, Jack, that it is high time that we leave not only the single-issue politics of the 1980s behind, but also the multi-issue politics of the 1990s behind. From my perspective, we're sort of a movement from single-issue to multi-issue over that period. And now what we have been doing in the last 15 years is building a cohesive movement that goes beyond even multi-issue politics. It's about a building for democracy in the United States. It's a struggle for power. Instead of simply uniting to ensure that each of us is more successful in achieving our own immediate goals in terms of getting a more just distribution of the spoils or a little bit more from the master's table, what you're seeing in the United States today is an emerging movement for democracy that says, we don't just want more out of the kitchen. We want to control the kitchen. We want to decide what's made. And so that democracy movement, I think, is critical. It's critical in making the progressive movement live up to its name. You know, like progressives, as you pointed out, have actually been reactionaries throughout much of my life. We have been reacting to things that are done, reacting to policies out of Washington, reacting to policies out of Dallas or Wall Street or Davos. And instead of having a proactive progressive agenda saying this is what we're for and what we're fighting for. And I think the democracy movement is the ultimate expression of that because, look, no matter what issue it is that you are most concerned about, no matter what issue is impacting you most directly in your life or set of issues, the basic underlying problem that all of us face, and this is the silver bullet, is the fact that we don't live in a functioning democracy in the United States of America. We have some democratic self-government in the U.S. But overall, the federal government especially, and certainly most of the states are, I'd suggest all of the states, state governments do not function democratically. They are dominated by major corporations. The elections are bought and paid for. Lobbyists roam the halls of government. And the problem has gotten worse, not better, over time. So unless we're prepared to win some battles but lose the larger war for the rest of our lives, we actually have to engage in a struggle for power in this country, for a change in the basic structure of government, change in our basic law, for a democratic culture in which Americans have a belief that not only do we have the right to govern ourselves, but we have an affirmative responsibility to take charge and to participate in government. And in order to accomplish that end, we have to have a movement for democracy. So you see that with efforts like the Move to Amend Coalition, working not only to achieve the We the People Amendment that makes clear that corporations don't have constitutional rights and money is not speech, but also to achieve a broader constitutional reform through a Right to Vote Amendment, amendments to protect our right to education, to health care, to a decent job, a whole constitutional restructuring of our basic law. in this country. So that's one example. You see efforts to democratize local government through, for example, the Participatory Budgeting Project, which is working to give the people the power to decide where where our money is spent and to take it out of the hands of local, oftentimes parochial, elected governments that are oftentimes dominated by landlords and developer interests. Participatory budgeting is an example of this type of pro-democracy activity. You see it in terms of students and people on college campuses and in high schools who are fighting for a democratic educational system in which not only do we have the right to a quality public education, both K through 12, but also higher ed, but we also participate in the governance of our institutions. We don't have corporate executives running the University of Wisconsin or the California systems. We have elected representatives running those systems. So in almost every area of society, you're starting to see movements for democracy where people are saying, we can do a better job of governing ourselves locally, where we can do a better job of running the factory through the growth of workplace cooperatives around the country. We can do a better job of running our banking and finance systems through the movement for public banks, state banks and municipal banks. We can do a better job of providing for the national defense with the movement to restore the National Guard and to bring up the National Guard as the citizen soldier system of national defense that propaganda says it is, and actually it really should be. And you also see it with this movement for constitutional reform. So to me, that's the progressive agenda that is very exciting.
Well, we can do a better job. I like that phrase. I think that kind of sums it all up. And as you said, if you're not after political power, you're wasting your time. And if you're not after it in a democratic fashion, well, you're double wasting your time because you not only will not improve, you'll make things worse. So I think you said at one point we're really talking about something bigger than the GSA, and you're absolutely right here. And we want to take a break here, but we come back. Let's expand beyond the GSA and what it's doing and trying to do and talk about what should be done here, what has to be done here on the progressive left to bring these various efforts and movements and fights together. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, and me and my guest will be back very shortly. This is your host, Jack Rasmus, show Alternative Visions. My guest is Ben Maskey, Chief of Staff for the Green Shadow Cabinet. We've been talking about getting beyond single-issue politics, multi-issue politics, and putting together a coalition and an effort to fight for political power. Yes, it sounds grandiose, but, you know, if you're not after political power, including in the institutions, then you're just going to spin your wheels with protest after protest. Okay, we were talking about the Green Shadow Cabinet and where it sees itself going and its role and assisting in trying to bring together coalitions and so forth, and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade on Steroids issue here that's looming large for all of us in the very near future as one of the initial focal points here for the GSC and its efforts. But we're really talking about something bigger. We're talking about which way for the progressive left in the U.S. So it is, and I think you mentioned, not just in a reactionary mode, responding to crises and trying to put out fires, you know, finger in the dike kind of politics, but attempting to show that we can do it better. In other words, there's an alternative way. There are other ways. We can do it better. Well, certainly those running the country aren't doing very well, are they? In fact, they're doing worse and worse by the day, it seems. Let's talk about that bigger question. You know, I've thought about this a lot too, Ben, and it seems to me that What we need is some sort of a move towards an agreement, not total agreement, but effort amongst those who are fighting all these different fights, and they're getting bigger and more important, to have a common vision. You know, I was a union organizer for a number of years, and to me, the vision was where you started with folks when you wanted to organize them. And it was a vision of it can be better. And when you say, we can do it better, that's really what you're saying. You're saying there's another vision, you know, and that's great. Not utopia, but another real pragmatic vision of how it could be done better. And the vision is how you get from being exploited and abused to having a union where you get a voice and defense, right? That's the vision, how you get from non-union to organized to union. And then, of course, the second step, just as important, is, well, how do you get from point A to point B? What are the objectives? What's the strategy? And then, of course, once you have a strategy, then you're talking about what are the tactics. Some tactics are disastrous, should not be undertaken, and others are more successful. So let's talk a little bit about your view of this bigger question, vision, objectives, strategy, and tactics. Where do you see the left should be going in that broad sense?
Well, I think the left does need to commit itself to that struggle for power, as you put it. And in order to do that, we have to build movements and organizations that are designed for that struggle. Most of the organizations, and certainly labor unions would be included in this, that we've inherited or that have been built up over the years, were created at a time in which we had the Cold War, and they were trying to play along in a supposedly pluralistic system, a system in which you have different sets of competing interests, and the idea was that everybody has a seat at the table or at least can be heard and would be able to achieve something on behalf of their own interests or the interests of their members. Well, if that idea that the United States is a pluralistic society with a pluralistic democracy were ever true, and I think there are certainly many of us who would say that was more of a myth than something that was a valid idea, it's certainly not true now. We don't have a pluralistic democracy in which the various constituencies and parts of our society have a seat at the table or at least heard. In fact, the majority of people in this country are silenced by our political system and our economic system. So what that says is the unions, the community organizations, the student organizations, the farm organizations, the various ways in which we've come together historically that were built up to sort of play for a little bit more out of what was being dispensed from Washington, D.C. or various state capitals, those organizations are not necessarily well-suited to the struggle before us. So we actually need organizations and movements that are designed to struggle for power. So let me give you an example of how this is different, right? In one particular area of life, if you look at higher education, you look at student organizing, which historically has been a critical part of any movement for progressive change, certainly in the last 150 years in this country. The student movement that passed on into the 21st century was a student movement that was characterized by single-issue groups, small little activist groups, and student government associations that doled out money that came from student fees, essentially from student union dues, to various organizations, and that would advocate at the state legislature or at the national level for the interests of students. So those are the types of student organizations that we had. Those organizations are not capable of dealing with the state of higher education today, in which pretty much every major institution of higher education is dominated by major corporations, where the price of tuition is such that in order to get a college degree, you have to put yourself into indentured servitude. So certainly people of my generation, the Gen Xers, and the next generation, the millennials, are almost universally in debt, those of us who went to college to the tune of anywhere from $30,000 to $120,000 on average. And so, you know, we're dealing with a very different set of circumstances in higher education than people were maybe 30 or 40 years ago in the United States. So what does that mean? Well, if you're going to deal with this problem in which increasingly student debt is becoming the way in which we're funding our colleges, and increasingly corporations are looking at our colleges and universities as a way to develop products for you know, research for production purposes, intellectual property that they can own and then bring to market. In other words, we're in a moment in which our colleges and universities essentially use students for labor and for our the capital that we're borrowing, and then enrich major corporations with the spoils. You have to be capable of actually taking on the administration and the entire apparatus. You can't simply go to administrators who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, or regents who are corporate executives, or state legislatures that are bought and paid for by a major corporation, and lobby on behalf of student interests or hold a protest here or a protest there. You have to actually be capable of stopping production in higher education. You have to be capable of shutting down the universities and colleges. And if you're going to be able to do that, you have to have organizations at the campus level that are capable of doing that. So what we need is new forms of organization at the campus level. We need essentially higher education unions that bring together undergraduate and graduate students, faculty and staff, and community members in one organization, one big union for higher education, because that's the only type of organization that historically has proven capable of shutting down universities and colleges and bringing the demand to bear in a way that it actually has an impact. So that's just one example, and you do see, I will say, you do see undergraduates and graduate students, faculty, both full-time and adjunct, and certainly people who are concerned in our communities, coming together in this way across the country, and you see a developing new form of education unionism in the United States.
Let me take your example and run with it a little bit. Along the lines of these key elements I talked about, vision, objectives, strategy, tactics. You know, on a union, let me give you an example on the union side. What's the vision? The vision is work with some security, work at a decent wages, work with decent benefits, etc. Okay, that's the vision. What's the objectives? Well, the objective is you got to get a union and you got to get a collective bargaining agreement. What's the strategy? Well, you can go an NLRB election, which doesn't work too well anymore, or you can go in some kind of a direct approach to get union recognition and bargaining rights. What are the tactics? Protests, march, demonstrations, strikes, boycotts, community support, so on and so forth, right? Well, let's take your example, student debt. How would we look at these four elements, vision, objective, strategy, tactics? Well, first of all, what's the vision? Well, the vision should be a free higher education for at least 4 years for everybody in this country. We know at least a four-year degree is essential to getting a decent job anymore since they're shipping all the other jobs offshore, right? What should be the objectives? Reduce the debt. You know, they're arguing about today whether it's 6.8% on student debt or something else, you know, slightly less than that. Well, heck, it ought to be 0.25%. If the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, can give bankers 0.25% interest rate for 4 years now, why the hell can't they do that for students? Why can't they simply take the 6.8% and say, okay, until we deal with this debt problem, because that's what the Federal Reserve was doing before, the debt of the banks, why can't we give the students the same deal that we gave the banks until their debt is reduced? Okay, that could be the objective. What's the strategy? Well, we could go electoral. We could go boycott payments. Organize boycotts against the payments, right? After all, the government owns the debt. We could demand the government expunge the debt. It holds that student debt, most of it. Why shouldn't they just sort of write it off, just as the banks wrote off the debt of corporations? You know, there are parallels here. But it seems to me that whether it's a movement for, you know, protesting against student debt or the union organizing or whatever, there isn't enough real thinking out of this vision, objective, strategy, and tactics. I think the GSE can play that role. I think that's one of its key roles. But beyond that, somehow these movements have to do more than just protest against a condition. If you want to change, you got to say, change the what? How are you going to get there? What are you going to do to get there? And so forth. And I think that's the advantage if you can bring these groups together and under an umbrella, some kind of organization umbrella, so that they all start getting serious about more than just standing out there and protesting about the change and about the fight for power. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we agree on that there is that role for the Green Shadow Cabinet, and if you go to greenshadowcabinet.us, you'll see that our four secretaries of education, our secretary of education and our three assistant secretaries of education have put out a number of statements on this issue, calling for student debt emancipation, making that demand clear. And I have seen, I've been able to track how their messages have gone out all across the various communities of people working on education issues. But I also, I'm not sure I entirely agree with what you just said, because I guess the point I was trying to make, and maybe I didn't make it as clearly as I needed to, is that it's actually even harder than that. I think we need new social movement forms. We need new ways of organizing. The old ways of organizing don't work anymore. And by that, I don't just mean, you know, the old ways of protesting don't work, but I mean that we need to organize for power. So in terms of campus organizing, the reality is that nobody outside of higher education has done much to help students in my lifetime. We've had some major struggles. Our right to collect union dues was taken away from us. We had a Supreme Court fight. We were targeted. We were the defendants in that case. It was called the Southworth decision. On paper, we won before the U.S. Supreme Court, but the whole process created a chilling effect that campus administrators, together with the organized right, used to take away our ability to leverage student union dues, our student fees, for organizing purposes. So if you go to a college campus today in the United States, you'll be hard-pressed to find a place where students are using student fees to advocate effectively in their own interests or in issues that matter to young people or to students in this country, right? And so I came away from that experience convinced that we needed to build capacity, we needed to build power in higher education, and that the only people who could do that were students themselves, adjunct faculty themselves, campus labor themselves, coming together and building new forms of organization, because the old ones weren't working, and there certainly wasn't anybody off campus who was providing the type of solidarity that they always seem to expect from us. I mean, the labor movement, and I've been a union member since I was 15 years old, but the labor movement just stood by and watched. You know, we asked. They didn't provide that solidarity. They lost, you know, the labor movement lost another link in the chain, to quote Phil Oakes. So the point being that, yes, we need the Green Shadow Cabinet. I think it's a very positive development to have this type of coordination, the sense that we really can do it better, as we've talked about, and to be able to bring into dialogue people who weren't even aware of each other's work. I mean, I've met all kinds of incredible people through this process, and my networks, the people that hear from me and that do, you know, pay some attention to what I have to say, they are finding out about things they didn't know about either, right? So that's positive. That's a step. But we We have to build these new organizations.
Let me interrupt you on that point. That's a key point, I think. What you described was a local struggle, and similar local struggles have gone on elsewhere, and different kinds of local struggles have gone on elsewhere, and you indicated the new forms of organization. In other words, nothing's really achieved unless you have some sort of organizational structure. What is that?
Right. Right, exactly. Well, I think it's student unionism and it's higher education unionism. And I want to be clear, I mean, I wasn't referring to a local struggle. I was actually referring to a situation in which students in Wisconsin were in leadership of a national student movement in the 1990s, and we were targeted by the Alliance Defense Fund in Arizona, and it ended up in a Supreme Court decision that has impacted the entire country. We've been in alliance with students in Canada and Puerto Rico and Mexico for decades now. We've been building those relationships. The student movement in the United States today is actually very well connected to what's happening across Latin America, North Africa, the Pacific Rim, and certainly Europe. So we do have that vision of a global resistance to what is being done, but we also have, you know, what the form is it is a form in which you have a higher education union, which includes as members, dues-paying members, students, faculty, staff, and community members who are associate members.
That's obviously not enough. Right, that's not enough.
You guys got legally
outmaneuvered and beat back. So that structure is not enough.
We didn't have that back. Well, we didn't have that back then, right? So we took some lessons from those experiences to say undergraduate students on their own cannot succeed, and so we
fight back succeed on its own by just focusing on the problems in the educational system is a bigger question.
Absolutely not, and it's true across
the board. Can the fight for health care succeed on its own? Can unions prevent their demise on their own? No. It doesn't look to me like any of the organizational structures for any of these movements are any longer sufficient.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. And I think that the reality is that when we come together, we don't come together as each an equal part of the puzzle. Each part of the puzzle is we're shaped differently, right? So the struggle in higher education is different than the struggle in rural communities. And the struggle around elections and stopping election fraud is different than the struggle for constitutional reform or to democratize the military. But these different struggles have to interact with one another. And I'll give you my own lived experience, again, here in Wisconsin. There is a reason why when Scott Walker attempted to call the National Guard out in the early days of the uprising, they refused to respond. And that is that there had been work going on for many years in Wisconsin around National Guard reform. And there had been work going on for many years in Wisconsin by organizations like Veterans for Peace and others to make sure that the National Guard in Wisconsin understood what their responsibilities and role really is, right? So that's one area of work that has been ongoing. That when the time came and people were occupying the state capitol and students and teachers were on strike around the country, meant that both struggles were more successful, right? You have cities around the country that are dealing with the problem of the crackdown on local democracy, most clearly in Michigan, where they've passed these so-called emergency management laws that take away local democracy, that make the elected officials powerless and allow dictators appointed by the governor to make the decisions. That's an example of how a struggle for local democracy on its own cannot succeed, that it has to be part of a larger democracy movement, that you have to have everybody working together. And so that's the type of movement that we need to build here. We are weaker on our own.
Well, maybe the fight against the TPP will clarify some of these issues. How do groups, and obviously there's a number of different constituencies are going to be significantly harmed by TPP, how do they come together in this fight, and how do they work together? How do they develop some sort of common organizational effort and bring together broader coalitions, and how can you do it not just at a direct local fight, but at the fight for political power? Because ultimately, unless you have a foothold in political institutions and in the structure itself, they will find a way to come back at you. And if they didn't defeat you the first time, they'll come back at you the second and the third time from another direction. So it seems to me that we're kind of creeping up on the issue of organization, structure. You know, it's not just vision, objectives, strategy, and tactics. So what kind of structure do you build? And that's the $64,000 question, I guess, today. Obviously, Occupy is not sufficient, and obviously, Democratic Party, those old kind of political parties, are not the road to go. Is there a middle road? Is there another way to construct and do a better job? Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, Brent, but you know, I want you to think about coming back after this TPP fight gets into high gear, and let's pick up this discussion again later in the year. I think this is one that has to continue and can't be resolved in 60 minutes, obviously, but will you come back later and we'll talk about this again?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and just a plug for the Democracy Convention this summer, democracyconvention.org, one of the places where we're grappling with these questions.
Very good. Democracyconvention.org. Look it up, folks. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We will be back next week. Streets are screaming now.